So I wanted to make this an informal type of session where people get to ask questions. And this devotee is, she's got some slips of paper in case somebody wants to ask a question, but they don't want to know, they don't want people to know they're asking it. So, what's the first question? Oh, I'm supposed to put this on so I can hear the questions. One very nice devotee has loaned this to me because I have such a hearing problem. How I met Srila Prabhupada? Well, I was going to school at the University of Texas, and I was in my senior year, and my fiancé and I were searching for a teacher, a guru. There had just been the first horrendous college shooting from the University of Tower. At the University of Texas is the very first time that this had taken place in America, where now it's an everyday event. But at that time, it was shocking. It was 1966. Yeah, 1966. And so shortly thereafter, we decided that we were going to leave. We didn't even know where we were going to go. We just felt the pressure of this civilization is crazy. And of course, the Vietnam War was raging at that time. And in order to be free from the draft, they would either draft you or put you in jail. You had to be enrolled in college. And so we left in the middle of the semester and drove to San Francisco. We had no idea where we were going, why we were going there, or what was going on. And this is, I think, true of many, many devotees, where they were just moved in a direction. And my theory on it is that when the lotus blooms, the bees come. They don't even know why they're going, but they go to the fragrance. So when we got there, we left on Thanksgiving Day, and we met Srila Prabhupada right after he arrived in San Francisco from New York, which was in January of 1967. And right before the mantra rock dance, you know, you've read about the rock current dance. And I was doing yoga meditation at the time. I didn't have a teacher, but I had a book on yoga, and it was like, I don't know, some past life thing where I just clicked right in to... I was doing like 8 hours a day meditation, and already we were vegetarian. It's like the yoga books would say, when the chela is ready, the guru will appear. And so we were probably unconsciously trying to make ourselves ready. And we really didn't know what we were doing. But it's really very funny because when we first got to San Francisco, there was a flyer that was passed around. And it said something like, stay high forever, the Swami is coming to town, chant Hare Krishna. And I remember Gary, who became Gorsundar, he got a copy of this flyer. And I remember him saying, well, there's this Swami coming to town. And when he gets here, we'll just go see him and we'll do whatever he says to do. Don't ask me where that came from. But that's... there were so many mystical, incredible events that took place around Srila Prabhupada. There's no end to it. I mean, if you talk, and in Russia, oh my, they never met Srila Prabhupada physically, but some of the stories in Russia, the people having the most extraordinary experiences. I had one fellow in my class in Vrindavan who was a former KGB agent, and his job was to protect, was to lock up the Ishopanishad. It was a dangerous book. This is years ago, you know, before Russia became populated with devotees. And so he, this particular devotee, I found it fascinating because they never met Prabhupada, but he was fascinated by the picture on this Ishopanishad, and he got an English translation book, and he started going to the forest because he was big in the KGB. He couldn't be seen doing this, and he started translating it, and he became obsessed, so much so that his wife started having him go to a psychiatrist because he was claiming that he was sick all the time. He was just going to the forest. Anyway, long story short, he eventually became a devotee. And there are so many stories like that, people having a vision of a Bhagavad Gita in a dream. I mean, Prabhupada was so... It was such an extraordinary excursion into an alternate reality that's the real reality that really exists. So, anyway, that's how we met him. I was meditating one day, and I went down, I read about him, and I had a wonderful experience in my mind's eye of him, and went straight to the temple. And the first meeting that we had, I asked for a meeting. Mukunda was there. Mukunda and Hayagriva. Hayagriva was there along with Shamsundar and Mukunda. It was just in the first few days of that temple opening. And I didn't even know that until I read Mukunda's book. I thought it had been open a long time, but it wasn't. It was just our first service was putting up those mantra rock dance posters. And the first meeting with Srila Prabhupada, we went into his little apartment. He had a tiny little apartment with a bay window looking over Frederick Street, which is right where the temple was. It was just a little storefront. And he asked us all kinds of questions. And he sat in a rocking chair, and I sat in one chair, and there was only two chairs, so Gary sat on the floor. And he asked us if we were students, what were we studying? He asked us where we were from, all kinds of questions. And then I told him I had studied in Europe. I had traveled and studied in Europe right after my first year of college. So I studied art in Europe. And he said, "Oh, you're so young, yet you have traveled so much," because I looked very young. And I said, "Yes, but none of it has made me happy." And he burst into a big smile and said, "Ah, yes, that is required." Because that is required whenever you realize that you're not happy. And I had everything. I could have, anything I would put my mind to, I could get it. And nothing made me happy. And I remember sitting on the campus at the University of Texas crying and going, "Well, I've gotten everything I've ever wanted, and I'm not happy. What will ever make me happy?" I think it's a very common experience that a lot of devotees in that era had, because we were searching for the connection that we had lost or we had had before. And then Gary, my fiance, he became my husband about 2 weeks later. Prabhupada married us. He was very consumed by anxiety over the draft, for good reason. At any time, he would be drafted because he had dropped out of school. And he came from a military family who wanted him to be a pilot, and he didn't want to do that. He didn't believe in the Vietnam War. So he expressed all of his anxieties and fears about this, about the war, about the draft, whatever was in our hearts, we said to him. And Prabhupada listened. He was called Swamiji in those days. He listened very patiently. And then I remember exactly what he said. He said, "You come to my classes morning and evening, and all problems will be solved." And, you know, we believed him. That what was so amazing is that if somebody said that to you today, you would probably just go, "You got to be kidding. I've got so many problems." But it was like there was such a certainty and such a realization that was communicated into the heart and the mind from Srila Prabhupada. And from his words, his presence, the Acharya is like that. He's able to transmit knowledge into the heart and the mind. And so we did. We came to his classes every morning and every evening, and all problems were solved. I mean, the main problems. We still have birth, death, all these and desires, but, you know. So was there another question? Is that sufficient? There's somebody picking up questions, but I don't see where she went. Okay. Halloween, trick or treat. How was it like? This looks like a child wrote this. How was it like when Srila Prabhupada smiled or laughed? That's a good question. It was just like the sunshine. And actually, I remember Bard Raj saying one time, we did everything we did in those days just to see Srila Prabhupada smile. Pleasing him was all we ever thought about. There was no money, there was no fame, there was no any politics, nothing, none of that existed. It was just, he was the center of focus, and everything we did was to make him happy, to have him smile and pleased. And so it was wonderful when he smiled at that, because you felt like your life, we just felt completely overwhelmed with joy within your heart. You know, just like whenever Krishna is pleased, like if you're serving the deities, everybody knows that serves the deities, that when Krishna is pleased, you feel that warm, expanding feeling in your heart. And you feel joy. Well, it was like that all the time with Srila Prabhupada when he was pleased. It was even more intense because we were right there. Of course, on the flip side of that, when he wasn't pleased or when you got yelled at for something, like burning the peanuts, it felt like it was the end of the world. And it really wasn't, but it felt that way. I spent a lot of time in the bathroom crying sometimes whenever that happened. So, because you wanted so much for everything to be perfect, but invariably something will go wrong and the peanuts would get burned or something, you know what I mean. But there wasn't that much chastisement. It really wasn't. I think that came later as things became expanded and there were so many managerial problems and there were so much complications and so many personalities vying for this or vying for that. In the very early days when I was there, there was just none of that. It was unheard of. It's like we weren't even aware that it would ever exist. Some people could foresee it. I couldn't foresee it. I was completely wrapped up with the day-to-day life of Srila Prabhupada. And you didn't think it would ever end.
Going to ask that, having you've seen the movement grow from its initial stage to where it is now, and you've seen all of the growth and the changes that have come, how do you see what's the most essential element to maintain, and how do you see that being preserved?
Of course, I'm not a scholar, but in my estimation, my simple, humble understanding, the most important thing to preserve is our respect for and our gratitude for Srila Prabhupada. He's the Acharya. People will recognize who he is 100 years from now, even 1,000 years from now. He said that. My books will be the law books. He said so many things. And I think the civilization is headed for a big turning point. I mean, he often said that this is, don't think, I was just reading something today, let's say, that he said. He said, what is this civilization killing father and mother, meaning cow? This is not good civilization. It will not stay. There will be catastrophe waiting. Many times it has happened, and it will happen because transgressing the laws of nature and laws of God is most sinful. So, basically, we can foresee probably within your lifetime, maybe within my lifetime, things shifting in society as we know it today. I'm not anxious for that at all. By the way, I'm not a doomsdayer or anything like that. But it's reaching a point where, there's problems on every front. And sometimes I wonder how it can even go on with all the slaughterhouses every day. I don't even know how it can go on. And so I think that when that happens, remember he used to say, the preaching will be very good after the war? Remember he used to say, it's a real common statement, everybody knows that, right? Well, that means when people suffer, when their status quo is shattered beyond recognition, then they start to question. Even just since 9/11, more people I've heard from Sankirtan devotees, more people are like, what's going on? They're frightened, they don't know, and they don't have anything to cling to. You know, I think they go to churches more, but still. It's, I think the gratitude for the Acharya, Srila Prabhupada, who he is, he even said once, if I told you who I am, you would simply faint. Everybody knows that, right? That's a common statement that you know it. Anybody that's been on the internet and has seen, you know, these kids, all these young people, they know all these things because they're able to access so many files, database and so forth. And so we're just at the very beginning here. We're at the very, very, Prabhupada came to this country in 1965, 66, ISKCON was formed. It's just a baby, really. And look, there's whole dynasties growing up here. There's whole dynasties of devotees. And that's the exciting part, that the third generation, second and third generation, the children of the children, he used to say, like these right here. And I don't know what the future holds. I'm not God. But Prabhupada definitely told us many times that the civilization is going to change radically. And he encouraged, in the last years of his time on this planet, he continually, practically constantly talked about getting self-sufficient form communities. In fact, one of the things he said in the very last in Vrindavan, I was just reading that, that he had wanted to introduce Vaishnavashram, that he wasn't finished, that was important part of what he wanted to introduce. And I can't say I completely understand Vaishnavashram, because I don't, but basically it's about land, growing your own food, keeping cows, agrarian lifestyle, which he foresaw would happen when the cities are no longer viable. Even whenever we were in San Francisco in 1968, toward the end of 68, 67 saw the flower children and the love era, all the hippie love era. And by the way, I want to make one point here. All of Prabhupada's early disciples were not hippies. Prabhupada said the hippies are our best candidates. But if you will look a little further, you'll see that most of his disciples at that time were not hippies. Mukunda Goswami was a budding musician. He had a big career ahead of him. Shamsundar was a promoter. He put together those big rock dances. He was quite well-known and well-liked. He also was friends with George Harrison later. We were students. There were many college students and many, Hayagriva, he was a tenured professor, the youngest tenured professor at the university he was at. So that's a misconception that I think has grown up somehow. But the people that we reached out to were frustrated and were hippies more. Brahmananda wasn't a hippie. He was working as a social worker. Satsarup was working as a social worker. Rupanuga was about to go to graduate school for, I can't remember what. But anyway, my point is that this is a misconception that really should be cleared up. I was never a hippie. I was in college in my senior year, a month before I met Prabhupada, and walked out, got a straight slate of F's, which I later changed. I overturned it because of the event that took place at the university. But that's an important point, because I think to deprecate those early disciples, it's offensive. It's just not, it's not true. It makes people maybe even look down on the movement, maybe even look down on Srila Prabhupada. That's important, I think, to understand. The hippies are our best candidates, and now the hippies are kind of no more, but the yogis are our best candidates now. The yoga students, the people who are going to yoga classes and observing various restraints, pratyahara, you know, all these are our best candidates in this day and age. So I don't know why I got off into that, but anyway, I did. So is that answer your question? Or did I get lost?
So you were mentioning that the most essential element is maintaining our gratitude and appreciation for Srila Prabhupada. So how do you recommend that we increase that?
That's a hard one. I think as an individual thing, each person has to find out what they can do. And they should read about him. There's a lot of books coming out now by Jamuna, by Mukunda, by Achyutananda. Achyutananda's is one of the best I ever read. And I think it's important for all of the second, third, and fourth, and fifth, and whatever generations to really grasp a personal feel for a relationship with Srila Prabhupada. And I think that's why these books are coming out, so that rather than seeing Prabhupada just as an icon or someone who's so beyond any kind of a personal relationship, I think that's one of the things that can be done, is to get to know who he was. Just get to know him. Because he's guiding everything still. And that concept is very common. I mean, they consider in India, Ramanujacharya, he's guiding his movement, and so is Vallabhacharya, and so is what I'm saying is the Acharya is way above and beyond anything that our little minds can comprehend. And Prabhupada himself said that. You'd simply faint. I know there's one dream that Hayagriva had in the early days, which was extraordinary. I remember being very shocked by it. And that dream was, he was in San Francisco. He had been working with Srila Prabhupada in New York since 1966. It was his article about Prabhupada that would describe him so perfectly that actually opened my eyes to him. And he was talking about this dream that he had, where he dreamed he saw a beautiful, golden, absolutely gorgeous demigod, just golden and effulgent. And in the dream, actually, he wrote about this in his book, too, and maybe not in as much detail, but he wrote about this in his book, Hare Krishna Explosion, because he was in San Francisco. At the time that I joined, Hayagriva and Mukunda and Shamsundar were the main ones there. And in the dream, this golden demigod being who was so effulgent turned into Srila Prabhupada, or Swamiji. And then he turned back into the golden being. And then he turned back into Swamiji. And he did this two or three times in the dream. And Hayagriva said, in the dream, he said, if this is who are you, if this is who you are, why don't you let everyone see this form? And in his dream, Swamiji, at the time, replied, if I showed everyone my form, they would follow me for my beauty. I want them to follow me for my teachings. Which You can read this in his book. It's Hare Krishna Explosion. It's quite a good book because it was an on-site description of everything that went on about the time that I joined, you know. So let's see. Let's move on to the next question. I don't know how much time we have here. Oh, this looks like a child's writing too. What does it look like when he's angry? Like a thunderbolt. Like a thunderbolt. It's, but actually, he didn't really get angry. He did things for effect, for teaching. It wasn't like you and I get angry and we just lose it. It was never like that. It was a teaching. One time I chopped the butter in the kitchen. This is just an example. And I didn't take the wrapper off. Well, that's a real bad thing to do if you happen to be cooking in the kitchen with Prabhupada. You're going to get yelled at for that one. So I did it, and I got yelled at. But it was a flash because he didn't want me to get burned by putting that. First of all, it's not clean to do it like that. But secondly, chopping it in half and then dropping it into the hot pan, I might get splashed. So you might say that when he got angry, it was more that he was teaching us how not to hurt ourselves in various ways. Because we're always finding ways to get lost and to hurt ourselves, you might say. This is a good question. Was there a sense of success, a very good question, in Srila Prabhupada's overall demeanor that the movement would be what it is today? Srila Prabhupada foresaw everything. I can tell you that I used to be I took dictation every day for his letters, and we lived in a small apartment in Montreal. There was no money. The Sankirtan party hadn't started yet. There were no books yet. The Gita wasn't even printed yet. And he used to talk to me about how he's going to have a world Sankirtan party. He used to talk about how he's going to have an auditorium with a stage where people could come so that there could be bhajans and there could be dramas, because he wanted it to be a cultural movement. He didn't want a Catholic Church type movement. He wanted culture, drama, music, art, all of which was to glorify Krishna. And every time I go to Bombay and I see that huge auditorium with the stage, and I just go, wow. He was talking about this in 1968, when we didn't even have money. I mean, my mother sent me money so I can get his glasses repaired. You know, I mean, she bought the tape recorder so that we could record those early lectures. And we didn't have anything. You have no idea. And it was a very, you know, we were a meager beginning. But he knew that everything was going to happen, and it was just separated by time. Because that's one of the siddhis of the acharya, of the pure devotee, is the vak siddhi, whatever they speak will come true, and to be able to see the future. He knew. And I'm amazed when I read some of his books, and I'm like, why did he put the exact train stations in here? Because he knew that the time would come that devotees would be traveling in India, and they would want to know where this train station is in Mayapur, and he traveled to here. Have you ever noticed that in his books? And like, you wonder, like, this was written by him in 1967 or 68, and nobody had even been to India yet then, and yet he knew. There are a lot of things he knew. He knows this concept of Western concept that we have that he's gone, it just isn't true. He is very much watching over this movement. And when it goes astray a little bit this way, he kind of moves it back and moves it back this way. And we have that in our own personal lives. We've all experienced that, where we get lost in this way or that way, and we feel, we ask Srila Prabhupada for help, and by golly, things get better. And we're able to remember where we're supposed to be most of the time. So did that answer that?
Yes,
definitely. Not only foresaw then, but foresees now as well. What was the most secret desire Srila Prabhupada have? I don't want to know any secret. What was Srila Prabhupada's strongest desire? Well, how am I supposed to know that? If it's secret to him, how am I supposed to know? I don't know how to answer that. I mean, what did he say?
What is his deepest desire?
Well, I mean, I'm a conditioned soul. I can't read his mind. He can read my mind, but I can't read his mind because he's not a conditioned soul. So, I mean, I guess I could guess at it and say that he wanted he wanted this movement to spread all over the world. He wanted to do what he came to do, which is to spread this movement all over the world. I mean, everyone knows he's the Mor Senapati Bhakta. He's the one that was sent. It's described in the scriptures how he was going to be his commander-in-chief, Lord Chaitanya's commander-in-chief. How he would go to the foreign, even if they flee to the foreign countries, he would go and bring them back. And we did, we fled to the foreign countries, but he came and got us. And so I would say, you know, his desire, it's different. We have desires. He just is completely in line with what Krishna desires. Our problem is we're not always in line with what Krishna desires. So that's a kind of a tough question. I'm not sure how to answer it or if it can be answered.
Told him that what you supposed to do in America, you blow the candle and desire secretly, and Prabhupada openly, loudly said it, and you told Prabhupada that no, you can keep it secret. You remember that? You made a cake for his birthday.
I don't understand.
You remember on Srila Prabhupada's birthday, you made a cake with the candles.
Oh, okay.
And you told Prabhupada, this is what we do on birthday in America.
And he said, I want only Krishna.
Right. Then you said, you keep your desire secret. But Prabhupada burst it out like he spoke loudly.
Well, yeah, he has spoken rather loudly about it all over the world. Okay, I see what you're saying, yeah. At the time when you served Srila Prabhupada, were you conscious how special this opportunity was? Yes, I was. Yes. I had some extraordinary experiences that, of course, I didn't have the foresight to know that things would become so big. I didn't even think about it. I was too busy doing my service. But I knew it was very special. I had the night that he had his stroke, or heart attack, Achyutananda assures me it was not a stroke, that it was a heart attack. We didn't know if he was going to be leaving this world or not. Before that, we were just like a family. We were like 10 or 12 kids. We were like, I was 20 or 21, and we were very young. And I think the oldest one was Rupanuga, And maybe Brahmananda and Satsarup might have been a year or two older. And we would sit around in his room every evening, and he would talk to us about everything, about Krishna, about it was just very, very sweet. And then suddenly, the tragedy happened where in May of 1967, it was either May or June, or 1st of June, he got sick. And that night was a very powerful experience for all of us. That's whenever he taught us the Nrisimha mantras. From that day on, we were chanting Nrisimha mantras because Tavakara Kamala, because asking Lord Nrisimhadeva to protect Srila Prabhupada. But what was extraordinary to me, I was perched by the window. There was a window between his bedroom and a little workroom. It was a tiny apartment, 26 Second Avenue, but that window was between the two rooms, and Jadarani and I were perched there, and maybe some other devotees. And inside Prabhupada's room, or Swamiji's room, was just a couple of devotees taking care of him, maybe Brahmananda, I think Brahmananda and Satsarup, and maybe also, you know, they would trade off. And he was trembling, and he was obviously, it was a very serious moment where it appeared like a life and death situation. And he was having them sit him up. He couldn't sit up. He was having Brahmananda and Satsarup or Gargamuni, who traded off, sit him up and open the Bhagavatam in front of him. His Bhagavatam, not the printed ones, his in Sanskrit Bhagavatam. Bhagavatam wasn't printed yet. There weren't any books yet. And so he was teaching right at that time. In other words, he didn't really care for the fact that he may be leaving this world. It was a very powerful experience where all he cared about was us, was teaching us, because he had so much. I never saw such unconditional love. It was so powerful, where his focus was completely upon taking care of our spiritual life. He was so devoted to his disciples, to caring for us. Anyway, at that time, I had some realizations of who he was. And did they record it? Somebody told me to record it. I don't know. Because one of my girlfriends in India asked me to. At the time, I had kind of a, I don't know, I guess you'd call it a mystical experience, where I realized who he was for a few moments. And I realized that he's not going to be with us very long, and that we should do everything we can to try to help him, to serve him, to take care of him, do anything and everything. And I remember there was a verse that went through my mind where Jesus said something like, the poor will always be amongst you, but I will be with you for a short time. The purport of that is that there's always problems in the material world. There will always be the poor, the rich, the troubles, and all this. But the saint, the messenger of God, he's here for a short time. And he's come from the spiritual world. And one should do everything within their power to serve him. And that whole realization swept over me. I mean, we were just crying, tears, you know, we were. And I made a vow in my heart. I think that was my real initiation, actually. That was my real moment of initiation. Because initiation, it takes place in the heart. People could be initiated on the outside and never really experience it on the inside. We saw that so many times, people who got initiated by Prabhupada and they went away and you never saw them again. But so shortly after that, he went to the hospital, and then he wanted to get out of the hospital. He actually broke out of the hospital. He didn't have a great deal of respect for Western medicine, I'm sorry to say. He was very much, especially, they just had him in the terminal ward. They did a spinal tap, which caused him to have headaches for years. Yes, that's exactly how I felt about it. If I'd been in the room, I would have probably shot them before they let him do a spinal tap. But I didn't know, I was a young girl, and I didn't know what a spinal tap was. I didn't know how it could affect people. So anyway, at that time, I made this vow, and shortly after he got out of the hospital, he demanded to go to the seashore. He used to say, my Guru Maharaj says the ocean air is full of vitamins. And so they got him a place at Long Branch, New Jersey, which is, I don't know how far from New York it is, but it's right on the ocean. And my husband, Gursinder, and I were asked to go there and take care of him. And that's when I started taking care of him. And externally, it was because we were artists and we could be spared from the community, you know, like Satsup worked, Brahmananda worked. But internally, I knew it was because of the vow that I had made. And so we were able to stay with him for 3 weeks then. And then whenever he went for India, he went to India, and that's when Achyutananda was with him in India. He had some of the most extraordinary association with Srila Prabhupada, just amazing. And thank you. And then, of course, whenever he came back, I was with him for about a year and a half, traveling and taking care of him. And yes, I would say I knew that there was something very special, that it was the most important thing in the world to do. I did know that. I didn't know that it would. I didn't have any idea that I'd be sitting here talking to 50 people. I had no idea that that was going to happen. But what I did have an idea was that I needed to devote my entire attention to making sure he was comfortable and taking care of him. And so, cleaning, washing, cooking, whatever job I was given to do. So that's what that question is answered, I think. I was conscious. But maybe I couldn't be possibly conscious fully. How does Prabhupada feel when children come? Oh, he loved the children. You could see so many videos of Prabhupada giving the cookie and patting the child on the head. He loved the children. He had a truly, you know how Indian people really love children. They have a genuine appreciation for the child as being like a deity, being like that should be like the mother should take care of that child just like a deity. And so he loved the children very much. And it was, he encouraged them. I remember whenever Malati and Shamsundar came by on their way to London, he picked up their little girl and held her above his head and said, "Remember me, I'm your old friend." And she was just about this long, you know. And then they went to London and opened temples there. So he was very, very kind to the children. What were Srila Prabhupada's sleeping patterns like? We'd only sleep 3 hours and take short naps. That's true. He would take rest. Well, the year that I was with him, most of that year, he was recovering. He was not. He was not really well. He had a lot of headaches, and he had a lot of buzzing in his ear. And then there's a reaction from a spinal tap, which the doctor can tell you. A spinal tap is a horrible thing to do. Horrible. They take fluid out of the spine. It's an insane thing that medicine does. Don't ask me why they did it to him, but they did. They stick a big needle in the spine, and that causes headaches for years afterwards. So he had a lot of health problems, and so a lot of times he would stay up preaching until 11 o'clock, and then next day he would be saying, oh, I shouldn't have stayed up so late, I wasn't feeling well. But he always got up like at 2 in the morning, 2 or 3, and would work on his books. Sometimes I would wake up, not always, but sometimes I would, and I would go sit by the door and listen to him translating. And that was an extraordinary experience because he wasn't alone in there. He would be singing the Bhagavatam. He would be singing the verses. Sometimes he would be like, you know, I mean, you knew, you could feel if you had any esoteric connection that there's a lot going on in that room that I can't see. And that's what he would do in the early morning hours. And sometimes in the during the day, too, because he didn't have so many, there weren't so many devotees then. I remember in Boston, there was just, you know, a handful of devotees. So there was Satsarup and I think Jadarani and like maybe five devotees, so that he didn't have a lot of guests. And so he would be working on his books also in the day, too. And he would be completely absorbed. I would peek in the keyhole to see if he needed anything, because we had one of those big keyholes in Boston, and he would just be singing and speaking Sanskrit and singing, and he really wasn't in this material world, to be honest with you. He was actually living in a... And I even told Satsarup that once. I said, you know, we have no idea who he is. We're cooking lunch for him. We're taking care of all these things. We're sweeping the floor. We're doing all this stuff. But when I remember in Boston looking in that keyhole, and it was like Mother Yashoda looking in the Krishna's mouth or something. It was like, I don't know who this person is, really. I'm doing all this stuff, but I have no real clear picture. I mean, there's a lot going on here that I can't see. So, I don't know if that answers the question. So yes, he did sleep a very little. He would take a little cat nap after he took his morning walk. He would go, I would clean his room while he took his morning walk. I didn't usually go on the walk because I had to have breakfast ready for when he got back, and I had to have the room clean, have his water changed. I had like a list on the refrigerator that I would just check off my list every morning, you know, and list for the evenings, you know, like change the water, do this, do that. He had a water pitcher right by his desk. And so in the morning, Gursinder would take him for the walk. I'm sure you've seen a lot of videos where Gursinder and Jadarani are walking with him. And I'm not there because I'm at home fixing the breakfast and cleaning his room. I had like only like 45 minutes to get everything done. And he would come back, he would have his breakfast, and quite often he would take a little rest afterwards, just leaning back on his cushions. And then he would call me in for dictation, and I would come in and take my dictation pad because I would type his letters, and he would have me read the letters to him. There weren't that many letters, maybe only 10 a day, hardly any compared to what he later received. But still, it was a lot, considering we didn't have computers. We had these things called typewriters, you know, it's like... manual typewriters, not electric typewriters. I still have my old typewriter that I used to use. Anyway, so then I would type his letters, and then he would read them over, and he would sign them. And when I would take dictation, he used to love to talk about everything. And he'd get off on different subjects for 2 or 3 hours. And I'd love to listen. I was just like a sponge. I would just sit there and listen. Anything he had to say. And so he would he would, and then in the afternoon, after his lunch, he kept a very regulated schedule, amazingly regulated later on. And when he traveled later on, too, Sutta told me that it was amazingly regulated, where he would take his nap after lunch. And he always liked to have two rooms, a work room and a sleeping room. And as soon as we would get to an apartment, which way is east? He would never sleep with his head to the north, always sleep with his head to the east, because to the north is not good. I can't remember why, but it's not good. So he would have a sleeping room, and he would prefer to have one room for working and the other for sleeping. And sometimes when we were in Montreal, because we only had two bedrooms in that little apartment, Gursinder would sleep on the floor in the kitchen, which was on the way to his workroom, and Swamiji would come shuffling. Well, no, he was Prabhupada by then. He became Prabhupada in May in 68 in Boston. And he would shuffle down the hall. I bought him these house shoes, and they made this nice shuffling sound, so you could always hear him coming. And I really liked that sound. Anyway, so he would come shuffling down the hall, and he would keep this debate going for days with Gursinder. He would wake him up with some kind of like Mayavadi question he would throw. I mean, he would take the devil's advocate, and he would have, because he was training Gursinder. Gursinder was a very scholarly, intellectual type of person who was studying Sanskrit and Bengali, and also was doing the transliteration of Chaitanya Charitamrita, and also some of the Sanskrit too. He'd studied in school. And so he would keep these lively debates going. First thing in the morning, you know, Gursinder would have his head in the sleeping in the kitchen, his head would be sort of in the hallway, and as Prabhupada passed by, he would throw a statement at him. And this went on, I mean, this was like an ongoing rasa. It went on for days. And I listened to it, but I wasn't, I was more involved in making sure that there was fresh milk and fresh food and fresh, you know, doing the prasadam and making sure that all the comforts were arranged for it. Okay, now this is the last question. I don't want to keep you too late. It's almost 8. I sometimes have trouble trying to arrange around. I sometimes have trouble trying to understand the relationship between Srila Prabhupada and my initiating spiritual master. I often feel a bit of schizophrenia trying to see how I should view them. How can I resolve this? I don't really understand this question. Srila Prabhupada is the acharya. It's that simple. If you have gurus, you respect gurus, but the gurus are not the same as the acharya. But everyone who has a guru, there shouldn't be a schizophrenia. There should just be a clear understanding that, I can give a real good example. Somebody wrote me about this today, a friend of mine in Houston who's an attorney. She's an attorney there. And she said, because I had written her back, and I said, "Dear Pranmohini Prabhu, please accept my humble obeisances," da 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 da, and I wrote her a letter about something. And then she wrote back, and she said, "I thought Prabhu was only for male devotees." And if you'll notice, all the old Prabhupada disciples call one another Prabhu. They all do. Right? It's just natural. And the reason for that is because when he took the name Srila Prabhupada, what he told us at that time was that Prabhupada means the lotus feet at where all Prabhus come and surrender. And you are all Prabhus, masters, that means masters, and you're all coming to my lotus feet, you see. So that's the meaning of Prabhupada. And we're all Prabhus who are serving. I mean, we had never heard the word before. And somehow or other, it's I don't know how, maybe it's gotten changed somehow, maybe it's gotten Indianized, I don't know what it is, but somehow there's this concept that it's only for male devotees. Well, we didn't have that concept because that's not what Prabhupada told us. He just basically told us the meaning of Prabhu was those who were coming to the lotus feet of Prabhupada. Right after he accepted the name Prabhupada in May in Boston in 1968. Prior to that, he was called Swamiji. Well, I think somebody raised their hand. Who? No, I saw out of the corner of my eye. Maybe it was you? Oh, it was you. Okay, but it was over there. Okay. Well, like I said, we were in Boston, and Gaurcinder was studying. He was studying Sanskrit, and so he was studying, and he was learning all these suffixes and prefixes and all this grammar and stuff, you know. And so he came to understand the word G, you know, G. Like we go Govindaji or Swamiji or this G or that G. It's an affectionate suffix. And so I remember I was sitting in front of Prabhupada's desk and taking dictation. And Gaurcinda was standing at the doorway of the room. And he said, G means an affectionate form of duress. Can I call Govindadasi Govindaji? And Swamiji said, no, you shouldn't do that. It's a very third-class form of address. And so I said, well, how come we're calling you Swamiji, if that's the case? Why are we calling you G? We would like to have something more first class. If G's not good enough for me, why are you being called G? You see, so G means, you know, the addition, everybody knows. Some people even call one another Prabhuji. All my God sisters say, oh, Prabhuji. and so then I said, well, it is important. And he's so humble. He's so humble. So it's not very important. I said, oh, yes, it is important. It's very important. Please tell us something that's more first class. If the suffix G is not very first class, please tell us something first class. And finally, with a little bit of pressure, he kept saying it's not very important. But with a little bit of like, yes, it is. It's important to us. We want to call you the best possible thing. We don't want to call you with a third class form of address. He said, all right, then you can call me Guru Maharaj. Or you can call me Gurudev, or you can call me Prabhupada. And I said, well, that's three. Which one is best? And he said, Srila Prabhupada is nice. And then I said, okay, from today you will be called Srila Prabhupada. And then I told everybody, and some people didn't like it. They didn't like that name at all. But then he explained what it meant. And I think it later caused some problems with his godbrothers, but I didn't know about that for years and years later. And I believe he said it reminded him of his Guru Maharaj. Then he explained that pad means feet, and Prabhus means masters. So I'm the Prabhupad, and you are all the Prabhus who are taking shelter. So for us, the word Prabhu was like, it was like an connecting to Prabhupada. It was like, he's the master, and he's the Maha Master, and we're the ones who take shelter at his lotus feet. So anyway, that's, how did I get off on that? I forgot. I mean, it's good to have an informal discussion because then that way you can wander and talk about different things, and if people ask questions, because, you know, I'm just like everybody else. I'm absorbed in my day-to-day life, and I have my problems and my this and that. But whenever people ask questions, it takes you back in time, and you're able to remember things And whenever we talk about Srila Prabhupada, he's present. That's why people feel so much joy. They feel so much happiness whenever. Look at everybody smiling. He's smiling. You're smiling. She's smiling. That's because whenever you talk about Srila Prabhupada, his presence is there. He's not dead and gone. It doesn't work like that. The acharya is beyond time and space. We're the ones that are in the conditioned bodies. We're the ones that are in time and space. We have a birth and a death. It's not like that for the acharyas. And this is something I realize it's very hard for Westerners to grasp, especially my generation. The younger generation, I think they're getting it more. And of course, Indians, this is like cultural, right? It's very cultural. They understand. Yeah, he's shaking. He's nodding his head. They understand that the acharya is not, I mean, he may come for a short time in a body, a physical manifestation, but he's not like us at all, where we're forced, just like when Krishna comes, you know? He comes to teach. And like Prabhupada used to tell us, I came from Krishna Loka to teach. I really didn't want to come, but you see, Krishna said, just go there and write some books. And so he used to tell us this, and I'm sure most of you have even read these things from different disciples. It's not new things. Anyway, it's 8:10. I don't want to keep everybody up. Is that all the questions? Did you have a question? Oh, there's two. Vidyananda, but of course I won't be able to hear from way back there.
They have a mic here. I was wondering if you had a favorite memory of Prabhupada from all your years of serving him.
A favorite memory?
Yes, particularly meaningful, and why it's your favorite.
Well, they're all wonderful. But I think I have a favorite memory. Being practicing yoga before I was a devotee, I'm inclined toward the otherworldly and the mystical experiences that are not explainable by this scientific reason, right? And so Srila Prabhupada came to Hawaii after he sent my husband to Hawaii to open a temple. After we were with him for over a year, he wanted us to go and open a temple. Okay, I really didn't want to go. I was very attached. He was just like my father. Why would I want to leave to go to Hawaii and leave Prabhupada? I mean, what's Hawaii got? Prabhupada's, it was like his room was like the whole world, and he was all the people. I wrote a poem like that once. His room, everything, it was like the universe was going on in there. You know, the letters were coming in, and it was just like a feeling that you were at the center of the universe. So I wasn't really keen on living, but I had to. So in 1969, I went to Hawaii. And I had been with him for over a year, but I didn't have very much experience in the world. I had been, as I said, a college student before joining him. I hadn't really gone out and worked in the world. So, but I was determined to start a temple, and that means, you know, somebody had to make money, and my husband was working, but then I stayed home as a housewife for about 3 weeks. That lasted about 3 weeks. And then I went out and got a job as an executive secretary for a big corporation because I had really fast typing speed and I could take dictation from all the time I had spent with Srila Prabhupada. So, so that meant I had a lot of association with worldly people. And I worked really hard to get that job. I went to a lot of interviews, and I wanted a top of the line job I wanted to be a secretary to the executive at the top of this big firm, which I got. I got the job. It lasted less than 2 weeks when I got a telegram from Prabhupada saying he was coming, and I had to quit my job. So I was livid. I was really upset about it. I was in Maya big time. And the amazing thing was I was doing all the right stuff. I was chanting all my rounds, getting up early in the morning, making lunch for my husband, Gorsundar, making lunch for me, following all the principles. We were very, very strict. And I had my deity there that also. And I was young. I had some energy then. God, I wish I had that energy now. And I got this letter saying, telegram. He was arriving like in a few days. And that meant there was nobody else to take care of him. I had to quit my job, right? So when he first got there, he knew that I was upset. He knew I would hardly speak to him. So, like, the reason I was upset, I had two wretched aluminum pots. I didn't have anything for serving him nicely. I was accustomed to having nice vegetables, organic milk. He got the best of everything when I was on the mainland. And I was just getting started providing this arrangement in Hawaii, or so I thought. I was just getting things off the ground, you know. But we had only been there less than, I came in January. He came in sometimes in February. So I hadn't been there hardly any time at all. And I didn't have it together. And so that's why I was upset. But he knew from Los Angeles, he could see my heart, he could see my mind, and if he hadn't come at that time, who knows if the Hawaii temple would have ever been opened. So the first couple of days, I was like really upset. But then I did my duty, did everything I was supposed to do, clean the house, cook for his own, you know, all that normal stuff, everything normal, except that he knew that in my mind, I was angry. I don't know if you'd call it angry. I was pensive. I really, really didn't like the fact that I didn't have it together. This interfered with my plans, right? I've got this big ego. I've got these plans, right? And all of a sudden, my spiritual master shows up. I know, this is inconceivable. Actually, you can relate to this if you think about it. So then, in the evening, as was our custom, everything was normal. I'd only been away for like a month or so. We chanted japa after Artik. This is what we did every evening. We did the Artik. He had his deities with him, his Radha Krishna deities. I performed the Artik. And then we would just, I think Gersinder was working in town. He was working days and nights. And so, because I had quit my job. And so I was sitting and chanting japa. Now, this is the most extraordinary experience I ever had with Srila Prabhupada. The temple room wasn't that big, but it was, I think, is about where he was sitting as far away as maybe you're sitting, doctor, maybe you're sitting about that far. And the deity was here. It wasn't a huge temple room, but it was big enough that there was that much space. And I'm sitting and chanting and looking at the deities. His Radha Krishna deities are on the altar. And he's sitting over in the corner on the diagonally chanting japa. And I'm sitting and chanting japa. Because this is how we ever spent every evening. Everything was normal, except my mind wasn't normal. But I didn't know my mind wasn't normal. That's the wonderful thing about Maya. You can be in Maya and not know it. And so then all of a sudden, I'm just sitting here looking at the deities, chanting, and all of a sudden these floods of realizations came. The feeling of bhakti came back to me, but I didn't know it was gone. This is the amazing part. I thought I was charging forward. Remember the ambition thing? I was charging forward doing this, but I had lost the essence of bhakti, which is depending on Krishna. I had lost the feeling. And all of a sudden it came back in a wave and tears started flowing down my cheeks. And I realized all these realizations were just flooding I'm looking at the deities, and they're just flooding that, oh my gosh, I've been contaminated by my association with karma. Association is like this. You got to work hard. You got to move forward. You do it, right? I'm the doer. And this is what I was contaminated with. But I didn't know it. I thought I was doing all the right stuff. And then all of a sudden all these realizations came, and so I turned to look at Srila Prabhupada, and he was looking at me, and all he did was nod. He didn't even say a word. He just nodded. So you show me somebody who can do that. You show me somebody that can go into your mind and your heart and give you realizations and open up, and that's my favorite memory. Anyway, he brought me back. I realized, and everything was okay after that. I was like, everything was normal. My consciousness came back to normal. But then it was really funny because right before he left, I got tested. The day before he was leaving, he was there for over a month. The day before he was leaving, I got a phone call from an agency that I had applied with. And it was a better job than the last one. It was closer to home. The other was an hour drive. This is like half an hour. It was better pay. It was as good as it gets. And so I went in and I asked Srila Prabhupada, should I take it? And he said, he knew how to deal with me. He was, he let me decide. It was like he didn't say yes or no. He said, well, you think about it, something like that. So then I remember we took him to the airport that day, and I went into the ladies' room and I dressed up, put on my nylons, put on my karmi clothes, and I looked in the mirror and I said, no, I'm not going to do it. It's too risky. It's just too risky. I didn't feel I was mature enough I didn't want to lose what I had. So I took it all off and never did it again, and Krishna said everything, and actually Prabhupada even said things like that you have to depend on Krishna and he will send everything. And he did. So that was my most powerful memory, because we can get lost so easily. And I was lost and I didn't even know it. And I was doing all, and I've seen it happen to other people too. They're chanting all the rounds, they're doing all this right stuff, But Maya, she's got so many variations of being able to entrap you into the concept that I'm the doer. I'm doing this. It's all about me. And of course, karmic philosophy is all about getting ahead in the world. It's all based in lower chakra stuff, which is survival, sex, and getting out there in the world and being successful. And that ambition is the antithesis of bhakti. It doesn't go with bhakti. I mean, you may have to do a job, but association with devotees will protect you from getting swept away by it. I mean, everybody has to work in something, but it's important to remember that it's pretty dangerous. In those days, it was extremely dangerous because it was just me and Grasinda in Hawaii. There wasn't anybody else. There were no other devotees. I think Kartikeya was there briefly, but it's a different world now. You have so much association, so many programs. So it's 8:25, and I think everybody wants to go home. Thank you so much for being so patient.
Keep going.
What is it? Well, what time is it supposed to end? Huh?
25 minutes.
In 5 minutes?
25 minutes.
Oh, it's supposed to last till 9?
Yes.
Yeah, well, some people have to go home and they have to get to bed because they have service. Okay, well, one more question then.
Hi, Bo. It's not a question, but when Prabhupada was recovering at the ocean, I remember...
Loud, talk louder.
Louder. Like that?
Yeah.
Like that? Okay. It's not a question, but I was hoping you could tell the story at the ocean side, something about you were growing... Prabhupada liked to sit close to the rose garden, and there was a real funny bug or something, and you were going like, ooh.
Yeah, it's just
Can you tell that story? Can you tell that story?
Yeah. Well, we moved to New Jersey. We went to New Jersey right after his stroke or his heart attack. And we had roses, lots of roses in New Jersey in June. And we would sit outside because Prabhupada used to always have a rose to sniff, you know. It's medicinal. It would help his headaches. And he considered roses to be... The aromatherapy is popular now, but he already knew about that. He was way ahead of his time, always. And so we were sitting in the garden, and I was sitting on the ground, and he was sitting in a little, garden chair. And I saw a slug, you know what a slug is? It's a snail without a shell. And I don't know, I was really childish. I said, ooh, look at that. And he got this look of compassion on his face, just like he could see what I couldn't see. I saw a slug, he saw a spirit soul trapped in a body with, you know, a horrible, yucky, slimy body. And he said, chant to the poor creature. And so I got down on my hands and knees and I was chanting to the slug. Well, I mean, I still chant to slugs, bees, lizards. I initiate lizards, spiders, bees. Any kind of creature that you chant to it a few times, and then it gets a really fast, it'll take birth as a human if it hears. And so it's a good thing to do. I read someplace that Haridas Thakur used to go through the forest and chant very loudly so that all the bugs and creatures and beasts could hear him, because they're in a lot worse shape than we are. I mean, they have a long way to go up the cycle of birth and death. And if we can help in that way, we should help. And it also helps us too. Anyway, so what it showed was how compassionate, his divine compassion. My sight was limited. All I saw was a slug. His sight was that of a soul. And a slug is about the most ugly creature that you can ever think of, you know. So it looks like all the questions are Rasikananda.
That I was thinking how attentive you, while you were describing, you were saying that you were so attentive to hear what Srila Prabhupada's mission was, and you were committing yourself to serving him, and that was your feeling of initiation within your heart. And so I was thinking about Srila Prabhupada's instructions and his initiatives that he set forth for his followers and pursuing them and making regular progress on them. So I don't know if there is any list anywhere of where are all of Prabhupada's initiatives that he set forth for us to pursue, and is there any system for measuring them and engaging devotees regularly and practicing them? And I was thinking that would be valuable, and I don't know if there is such a list of, like, what are all the things that Prabhupada... I mean, there's everything that we have in all of his books, Be Krishna Conscious and How to Be Krishna Conscious, but then there's practical initiatives like opening temples and establishing Varnashram and like that. Is there any particular list of all of his primary engagements for his devotees?
Well, I guess there is. You'd have to probably scour the teachings and come up with a list. But I know toward the end of his life, he talked about Varnashram all the time. In the very beginning, he gave a simple, very simple format of, you know, chanting and coming to the morning program. There wasn't any Mangalartic at that time. We were doing good to come at 7 o'clock. And so I don't completely understand your question, really. You mean like a list of things that he considered important? Is that what you mean?
I guess so. I just see that I do a lot of work with devotee projects, and everybody comes up with an idea and says, this is what is the most important thing, and I'm going to devote my life to it. But I don't see that too many people reference particular things that Prabhupada has given as an instruction. So I'm looking to see whether or not he had emphasized that, or whether it was up to individuals' inspiration to pursue what they wanted.
Well, I think everybody has a role to play. I mean, just like he had Jadarani painting art. That was her role. He had me doing artwork also. He had somebody else studying Sanskrit and somebody else. You know, everybody has a role to play, a part. But he's in charge of all of them. And, that was very vicious. This mosquito zone. I mean, in the very beginning, his focus, of course, was to get people basically to a certain stage. But then 10 years later, before he left this world, he started focusing on Varnashram because he knew he had many devotees by then, and he wanted them to be protected, and he wanted to protect the culture that he had started. And so I think you might say that according to the time and the place, he wasn't talking that much about Varnashram in New York in 1968. At the same time, it was in his books. A lot was in his books about keeping land, keeping cows, and keeping a simple civilization. And you have to remember, this has just happened in the last 100 years. I mean, even my grandparents, what did they have? They had some land, they had fruit trees, they had vegetable gardens, and they had a couple of cows, and they didn't have a lot of money. They couldn't kill those cows. They just got milk from those cows. And they had some chickens, and they ate eggs. And, you know, this culture, so-called civilization, is very recent. And many times he would say, it would be out of the blue. I never really completely understood it. These mosquitoes are trying to bite me. He would say, I do not very much like this Western civilization. Do you like this Western civilization? I do not very much like it. Well, I never knew anything else. You know, I mean, I learned to drive at 15, just like everybody else in this room probably did. Started driving at 16. I went to college, went to, you know, so I didn't know anything else, but if you stop and think about it, this whole culture, so-called culture, has agribusiness, all this. Ow! The vicious creatures here. This whole culture has just started since the Industrial Revolution. Before that, that's what people did. They grew their food. They, you know, it was a basic. And I just read some things he said about that today. He said, that man is to own a certain piece of land is a basic civilization. Every man must have a portion of land to produce his food, and then there will be no economic problem. The whole world situation is degrading, because people are not providing their own food. And you see what's happened. People aren't providing their own food, and so there's mass slaughterhouses. Now there's these Monsantos and these horrible chemicals that they're poisoning the world with. This wasn't there 100 years ago. This is all very recent. And he could see how it was going to get worse and worse. And so he was encouraging the devotees to start growing things and to start thinking in terms of when this civilization would no longer function as it is functioning right now. And I think we're getting closer to the edge myself. A lot of astrologers think we're getting closer to the edge too. I mean, the oil crisis, I don't know if it'll be the oil crisis or the debt crisis. or the paper money crisis. He used to talk about how paper money is useless. He used to talk about that all the time. Or the Ebola crisis. We got a new one on the skyline here, you know. So I don't know what it'll be, but at that time, things, just think, when Prabhupada was here 45 years ago, things weren't as degraded as they are now. They've actually increased in craziness. So I think according to the time and circumstance, what would be important. I mean, there's going to be a time, he used to say, these guys are so vicious. There'll be a time whenever, he used to say, the cities will become a hell. The cities will become a hell. He used to say, this Varna Sankar will make the whole world into a hell. And now you see that's what's happening. And then at one time we were more in the cities, but before he left he was encouraging agrarian communities. He was encouraging devotees to start thinking in terms of when the cities would no longer be inhabitable. Oh no, I'm not going to. I think it's time to go. I'm getting eaten alive, and everybody's tired. But thank you very much. We'll do this next Thursday, so you can think of some questions, and I hope it was helpful to someone. Thank you. I'll definitely use this for class in the morning. You know, I'll get one like it. It's great. Thank you.